Hey, welcome everybody back to the Reflex Blues Show. I am your host, Donovan Beery. I have with me Alan Espiritu and Kevin Kernan. All right.
You nailed it.
Kevin, Alan, great to have you. You guys are GD Loft, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, anytime you know a business or a name starts with like three consonants, never quite sure.
Yes.
You know?
Yes,
it's
yes.
GD Loft.
Yeah.
Or GD Loft, I'm sure. There's not the periods. Yeah. And we're here at the How Design Conference 2018 in the bowels of the Heinz Convention Center in Boston.
Yeah.
It's a great conference, and you guys are speaking here. Right.
No, we received an award this morning.
So that's what it was.
Yeah.
I knew you were like in the VIP area.
Yeah.
What's the award?
We won the Print Regional Design Award for 2017, the grand prize. So we won the region of the East, best of the East, and then we went on to win like the grand prize, beat out all the other regions.
So that thing where they said if you enter. Mm-hmm. You could win a trip to Howe.
It's real. We really won the trip.
Okay. I just want to make sure. Because, you know, you see that. You know, you could win this, you could win this. And that stuff really does happen.
Yeah, yes. It really does happen.
We had to find our own transportation then.
You're here. We're here today.
We're
here.
You got the ticket. Okay, you got it.
Yes,
And what was the piece?
The piece we did for AIJ's Philadelphia's 35th anniversary, and
it's a series of three posters actually that utilizes lines, like simple lines, to kind of represent the chapter history. It's made out of 420 lines, which equals the
we know the 420.
Yeah,
which equals one. Yeah, it was how many years? 35 years.
So it's,
which broke down to 420 months.
Which was,
that's the 420.
Yeah, that's it.
And then it kind of utilizes language too. There's hidden things within the posters, within the lines of it, and it uses Bowie lyrics actually as well
from Changes, and we also use the colors where commemorative for 35 years was. The coral and the red and the black came about because we wanted to print on, like, our printer came to us and was like, I can print white right on black paper on a digital press. And we were like, great, bring that HP Indigo in and we'll work with that. So we were really trying to push the technology at the time when it came out.
Yeah, and those colors are conceptually represents like colors that are related to 35th wedding anniversaries or things like that.
Yeah,
so
that's
colors
one of those
are connected.
Like, I mean, that's like the forgotten anniversary.
Yeah, exactly.
People, I mean, 25 is a big
25.
Thing.
Yeah.
Even 30 is kind of big.
Yeah,
and then it goes to 40, and people are like, oh, yeah, I guess there's 10 years between them.
Yeah. It's like coral,
and emerald.
I think, and emerald were the rocks connected to 35. Yeah. So we kind of use those colors in the original posters. And then Nina asked to replicate them, like to use their kind of new paper.
Yeah.
So we redid the posters and printed them on their new Nina colors.
They're cobalt blue and their imperial red.
And I'm also
doing a little bit of blogging from the conference, so check those out, ninapaperblog.com. And you guys will be signing these tomorrow.
Yes.
And so I'm sure I did a recap of your signing. I'm sure I remember to do that tomorrow.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. We'll be there 2 to 4 tomorrow.
Okay. Well, so you guys, it's three posters, and now. You guys spent all this time with the coral and wedding stones.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Nobody sells coral paper.
No. Yeah, I know.
So did Nina say, come on, like pick something else?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course, to translate the piece for when you get Nina involved, of course, there's also some marketing strategy that has to be incorporated in the new design. So we just kind of adjusted the size a little bit, but definitely used the papers that were kind of connected to the color, at least in the lineage of. So those were the closest ones. But I really like the paper color because it's
bold.
Pretty unique and bold. Like in the intensity of the paper color.
This is
color.
A black, a red, and blue.
Yeah. It's pretty intense. Yeah. Like, you don't see that very often.
What was the distribution of the original poster set? Like, like that you guys did? So the
original one, how they distributed them was the night of the 35th anniversary party in Philadelphia. We were at WeWork and they had them all out on the tables for people to take. Our posters disappeared very quickly. We only have one set, and we're like waiting for the. We've done some reprints, and they disappear too. So like they're always kind of coming and going. But yeah, it was just hand distributed,
and it was regional. I mean, it wasn't on a national.
Didn't mail out, anything. Yeah.
But it became the show was Philadelphia designers were selected to create commemorative posters of the 35th anniversary. So there was a bunch of 35 designers from Philadelphia were asked to create like posters. So we were part of that show. But then all the posters actually became part of AIGA archives.
Yeah, the National
like
Archives.
The National Archives now.
And I believe they keep one a set in New York and they keep a set in Denver.
In Denver, yeah, at the museum there. Yeah. Cool. So that's kind of nice.
One day we'll get out there and see it.
Yeah. We have another piece there that that was part of AIGA winning and, you know, the AIGA award, competition. But I went out there, but I didn't know where to go.
I don't know either. Yeah. Anytime you hear a permanent collection of,
it means it's in a drawer or something.
It's Indiana Jones style.
I was thinking
it's
that the ark.
They're like, we'll get a forklift. Yeah. Give us about 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
I had that same thought.
Yeah.
I saw on social media. My friend went out to like the the Library of Congress and they keep copies of every book or whatever. Mm-hmm. He requested some friends' books and he brought them up and showed them like on Facebook. Like
that's
like,
great.
I found him here. Wow. They probably already had the copies. They just wanted to see him in the Library of Congress. Like they will actually go find them for you.
That's amazing.
So next time you're in Denver, I guess you make them go find you.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, we have a couple of pieces.
That's just out there in summer. Think of that.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, oh, this is all dog ear.
Yeah.
Someone was eating a peanut butter and jelly
sandwich. Right, exactly.
Staring at them.
Missing pages. Discoloration.
It's rolling papers.
So these are great. You've got the David Bowie quotes. The posters look amazing. I can see why it won a regional. Why you guys are here. What was the connotation with David Bowie in the Philadelphia?
Was this
before or after he had?
This is after he unfortunately passed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Bowie's just a studio favorite, first of all. Yeah. When we're working, you know, he's a huge David Bowie fan. Yeah. I mean, I'm a fan as well. So we play Bowie in the studio a lot. But, I mean, he
recorded in Philadelphia, and he did some music videos at the Spectrum. I think he did Sound and Vision there. So,
that's our
Philly connection, but
simple Philly connection.
I grew up on him, so when it was talking about, you know, we did the song Changes, so when we were thinking.
It talks about time over
the years of AIGA of how things have changed in Philadelphia through the organization. We just thought it was appropriate to bring in.
And language and pop lyrics and lyrics in general are definitely part of our kind of vocabulary. Like when we're making work, there's always little hints to like, I myself, when I lecture and stuff, every lecture is titled after a pop song.
Okay.
Like I did one lecture at University of Delaware that went through the tracks of Purple Rain. Mm-hmm. Like, so every point had something to connect to, like, each of the title tracks. I think, like, you know, pop lyrics or lyrics like that in general are just an easy connection with an audience, right? I mean, it's one of the simplest, like, common denominator kind of connections, I think.
Yeah, there's something about it. I mean, songwriting where when you read the lyrics without the music,
right,
they're very short.
Yeah.
Like a song can have you're like, there's like 30 words here. So some of those effective pop songs, they have to be very selective with their words.
Yeah.
But it's very selective. Like you can say so much with like 6 words.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I can see why they work well.
And it's the weirdest thing. If you deconstruct pop lyrics, first of all, there's a formula to the language. It's a simplicity of language, right? But at the same time, like when you take them out of context, they sound so deep and philosophical. Like you can take, I don't know, Madonna lyric and just, it can sound like it's talking about, I don't know, like, you know, philosophy or something. Yeah. That's, I kind of like that kind of weird contrast between, like, you know, Britney Spears line in context, but taken out, it's like, oh my God, that's life-changing when you put it by itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
We're going to be right back with Kevin and Alan from GD Loft. So, Alan, you guys are both active in the AIGA Philadelphia chapter.
Correct.
Alan, you were on the board.
A previous president as well, yeah.
And you're actually an AIGA fellow. Congratulations.
Yes. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And I hear that you're like also teaching full time.
I am. Yeah.
So how, like, I teach one night class and it about destroys me. Like week one, it's all good. But like I can't imagine running my shop and teaching full time as well. Is that like a design problem you had to solve? And what made you want to do it?
It's one of the problems I haven't fully solved, but there is a way to kind of go around it. I mean, the one way is you build a team around you that's supportive. The studio started in 2003, primarily by myself and students that I would take on. And through the years, we've taken on like a lot more clients. So I had to assemble, you know, take on a business partner, have some graphic designers on staff. But that balance between teaching and running a studio is definitely tough. But you have to just have the support around you. But before that, I was designing in between classes in the morning, before classes would start, take client meetings like at lunchtime. It had to be timed, or I would leave the room during, like, while the kids were in work session, and I would take a call, come back in. But it's definitely a nonstop kind of roller coaster kind of thing. It's definitely not easy. Definitely not easy. You know, but I've found a way to make it work, and you just kind of have to work nonstop, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Not much sleep.
We try to lift some weight off him.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, to have a designer, to have a business partner, I mean, those things, he can take the call, he can talk to the clients while I teach, and I'm gone from the studio 2 days a week. The most part.
It's not bad. Usually our clients, we're pretty upfront with them about it, so they know sometimes Tuesday and Thursdays are just off limits for meetings or calls with, you know, the both of us. But I'm happy to always jump on, and most of them are pretty responsive with me going out there on a, I'll take the design, one of our designers with us, and go out on a Tuesday or Thursday and meet with the client. You know, it's always crucial that Alan's there. But like for new clients, we always like to be there at the same time just to get a good first impression.
Yeah. It's like having two lives parallel. You have to know when one stops and when the other begins. It's like constant, like, being in check, like, sometimes.
But I assume they also feed into each other. The negative is the schedule, but the positive is...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Alan stays fresh seeing, like, new perspectives from students and new technology that's coming up, and we bring a lot of some of that thought into the studio. And, you know, originally it started as, like, a think tank, and we're trying to preserve kind of, like, how can we keep pushing the limits of design for ourselves and our clients.
But, yeah, I mean, I can't envision my world now without teaching. I mean, that teaching really does, like Kevin said, feeds into my own process, or at least it makes me question my own process and develop my own process more. It also, you get connected to the zeitgeist of what kids are, like, really, what's going on. Like, you can, you know, designers have a tendency to just kind of be insular a lot. Like, we can kind of be cave dwellers and just stay in our comfortable place. But with students, like, they really bring up interesting issues that, you know, are like things that I usually don't think about.
Yeah, and it just even helping them, you see, like, you solve problems you didn't know existed.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
Then you're like, oh, I might be able to, like, use my own advice.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I took a 7 or 8 year hiatus off of teaching. I got back in about a year ago, and I love it.
Yeah,
So I get it.
Yeah, it's a
I just don't think I could do it full time in addition to what I'm doing. So. Godspeed to you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. We'll see how much longer. I can't wait till retirement, honestly. And I don't have to deal with administration and other professors. I think that's a hard part.
But then we get them at the studio.
Yeah, yeah. The studio becomes a safe haven, honestly. It becomes like that resting place for me when I'm in there. I'm focused. When you're at school, you're just constantly all around. But again, the conversations are the best part of school and bringing that into your own kind of ways of making and questioning your own ways of making, you know?
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, and your network always grows.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah, right. The network of everyone knows each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, nationally, graphic design, like, you think it's a big. I mean, it's vast, but it's weird. Educators, like, it's not as big as you think when you think about it. Like, in terms of education, like. There's only a few places that have full programs and stuff, and you get to know these people through conferences and just through their writing or the works of the students, actually, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the network grows through the students as well. Like, today I just bumped into someone who also got an award from IBM, who I have a couple of students that work at IBM, and she knew her.
Oh, wow.
She's like, oh, I know her. She's my neighbor, and I'm working with her on a project. So that, again, like that network grew. Exchange cards, and you're like, oh, there you go. Another new person.
Yeah, and so in addition to this, because you need more hobbies, you also you say you're doing fine art. The studio is doing fine art.
We do experiments in the studio, and like we get asked to be part of exhibitions and shows. Like last year, Alan was invited to be part of Person of the Crowd for the Barnes Museum in Philadelphia. It was pretty well.
It was definitely a highlight in my fine art career. It's weird because I've always kind of balanced between the two worlds of graphic design and fine art. Mm-hmm. I've always been in the middle, and some works that naturally come out are like, oh, this is not definitely not for a client, or I find ways to adjust it for a client, but then keep the original intention to make, you know, self-initiated works. So yeah, I've been showing at galleries and museums a lot, like lately with the self-initiated stuff.
We were just in one recently that raised money for a local Philadelphia high school to get art supplies, and so I did a letterpress piece. I do that in my spare time in the studio, and then Alan did a piece where he actually builds up a thick base of paper with glue, and then he starts tearing away, almost like you see like those New York like posters on the side of like building where people just keep layering them up thick, and you see them ripped or torn from the rain, and he's doing that with his work right now. So it's pretty interesting to see that process. And
yeah, I'm making these big rip pieces, and it's funny because when you start ripping paper, it's just like paint, actually. It's like if you layer it with color and stuff, and you're like slowly ripping away, it's like manipulating paint. You know,
it's like it was
interesting.
It's like making your own scratch board, but
different. Yeah, it's really kind of intense. Like it was more physical and intense than I thought it would be. I've had this idea for like a while, and I just came back from Berlin, where street culture and like poster culture is amazing there. Like, and the thing was, they don't take the past posters off the wall. They just keep layering it till it's this, and it becomes like sculptures coming off the wall, which is, it's like so thick, like you can get a foot of like old posters.
Oh,
and and it'll stay there, and they start
insulation.
To kind of
keep you warm.
It's beautiful. It's awesome. So that was definitely one of, you know, that got that idea kind of going. So, yeah, the ability to kind of be in different venues from, like, you know, in the graphic design world and the fine art world, I mean, they're totally different, too. They're two different total worlds.
But have you been able to incorporate it back into it?
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
I think it's like attracted some clients that were interested in what we were doing in the fine art world and have brought them into the design realm.
I think that's why we became pretty big in Philly, because we were mixing fine art methodology with graphic design. Like, so for example, we created an exhibition catalog that was also a piece in the show. So the thing was a traditional catalog, but the cover asks the viewer to make something from it. It was a paper architecture show. We kiss cut these shapes on or
little
corners,
triangles
on the corner, and the actual audience were asked to make our piece in the show.
Oh wow!
Yeah. So they
our
can
stuff's
create
so terrible,
design.
You can just make it yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
In 5 minutes in the conference,
and we're that lazy. We're asking you to make our work for us.
That is a design solution I can stand behind. It.
Yeah,
I'll
exactly.
give you props for that. I'd put that as best of show right there.
Yeah,
it gives it like an aura, so like people want to hold on to it a little bit longer. They have a personal connection. They just don't make it a disposable object that they want to throw away because now they've interacted with it. They created something on the cover.
No, I love it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. And that's the kind of thinking that we definitely like to bring to the work. You know, it's definitely a methodology that's developed over the years.
We think about how we can be sustainable. Like, you know, there's a traditional sustainability that everyone knows with recycled paper and green power and all, but we're trying to think about how can we sustain these projects and give them a longer life.
Or dual lives
sometimes where they have dual purposes and just keep them in people's hands longer than instead of a landfill.
Yeah. So it's true. I mean, we're in a field where, you know, we just add to the trash of things. I mean, and you can't help that, but could there be another way of thinking about sustainability other than soy inks, which no one can I've never really ever afforded it with our clients.
Yeah.
And we use recycled paper, of course, but, you know, there are limitations because of budgets. So there's got to be other ways to kind of think about it.
Yeah, and those are just like patchwork.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of
times. Yeah, you know, and I mean, unless you leave design all together and not produce anything, you know, then that's being sustainable, I think. But we
try to do our part.
We love design. So, I mean, I'm not getting out of it anymore time soon. So
we're going to be right back with Kevin and Alan. So I'll ask you, since you know, when we get a full-time professor on the show or whatever, we always say, like, we always ask, you know, you got tips for the students.
Yeah.
But so like, we'll just ask, like, what are the, not only, like, what are the tips you would give a young designer or a student that you think they would know, just random, maybe the one, but also, like, what are the questions they ask you the most?
Yeah. Well, the tip that I always tell students is you never go for that first job because of money. You have to, I've had students, like, get job offers for, like, a first job, $45,000. You got to think logically. They're going to give that to someone new, like, in the field, $45,000. It must be a job no one wants, you know? Like, or it's like, you know, like, so you got to think of, as a designer, the only way you can get a job is your portfolio. So you got to realize that first job shouldn't be about money, but it should be about, can this job develop my portfolio? Can it add to my portfolio so I can get to the next job? I think students think a little too short-sighted when they think about, like, you know, that, you know, their careers in some ways.
Yeah, you're not telling them don't take the money. You're just saying,
saying
don't make that the only consideration.
Yeah, it can't be the only consideration. I mean, if it's not, you got to get something out of that job, either more technical skill. I mean, there's got to be something that you, not just the money, but thinking about your portfolio is one of the most important things. It's the only way you can sustain a career and get the next job, is that you're doing work you have a portfolio that's constantly growing and creative. I mean, you're a teacher too. I mean, what do they say as well?
I think.
Well, we should mention, where are you guys teaching at? What are the universities?
We both teach at Rutgers University. I'm
the Camden campus. Yeah, yeah.
I'm a part-time lecturer there, and Alan is a full-time professor there.
Okay. So,
I think like students now too. I've been seeing it for the past couple of years, especially when we get resumes in the studio and we see students. They start branding themselves when they have no brand like behind them. Like they think like I'm going to make a logo and slap that real big on top of my resume, and it's kind of sometimes right away like tells you who they are when maybe they shouldn't be telling you who they are. You know, like let the typography speak for itself. Let the hierarchy kind of tell the story and show your typographic skills, and like I think a lot of them are like get caught up in making a cool little like illustration on their resume that like is beaming, you know.
Yeah, I'm far more interested that I can see a kid's way of thinking about stuff. The other question I always get is what should be in my portfolio, how should I make a portfolio? And I think that's an interesting question now. I mean, when we interview students, I mean, or potential designers, I mean, portfolios can be kind of anything now, right? I mean, from the iPad to physical work to the... But for me, I tell students all the time, it's a design problem. You should show me that you thought about your portfolio like a design problem, that you thought about audience, you thought about like how it's going to be presented. You've kind of put yourself in the scenario of the interview and how you're going to display the work. Like that's, you know, I mean, that's the other piece of advice that I give them. Don't make a portfolio just because you saw the other person do that, do whatever. But think about it as a design problem that has a specific audience, has a specific use, you know?
Yeah, I mean, my audience is Alan, so I'm going to repaste every piece I've ever done together to about a foot thick, and then I'm going to carve my logo into it and send you that.
You go.
You won't be
man.
Able to see any one piece, but I've solved my problem.
There you go. I
he would probably
that.
Rip around.
Yeah.
Rip away it.
It'd come back and the logo would look better, and I'd be like, yeah, I guess I did that one wrong.
Yeah. And I'm also attracted to students that aren't attracted to design. Like most of the studio, like the kids we get, interns in the studio, I love, you know, people that fall into design, but we're like, you know, like psychology.
Biology majors. They bring an interesting perspective to design.
Yeah, that we don't think about, and I kind of like that. We've had fine artists, we've had a psychology major, a business major. I mean, anyone that like has other interests than design to me is actually far more interesting than one who's like obsessed with designers.
Yeah, you have a team that has more than one designer on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if design projects aren't just the final designed piece per se.
There's
a lot of elements that go into the copy and all that. So so bringing in someone like that can make a lot of sense and be fun. And you can, you know, find part, you know, jobs for them.
I mean, they definitely have to bring some certain skills that are usable. But, I mean, the conversations and the perspectives.
Oh, everyone can open Word.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And there's spell check, you know. So we're good. So someone interesting like that for me is always, you know, we always ask what your outside interest is.
Yeah.
You know.
I think another thing, too, is, like, right now students are asking, should it be presented on an iPad? Should it be on, you know, like a traditional print portfolio? I've interviewed people, and I've seen both, and I've seen shortcomings with showing it on a tablet because, one, if they're trying to get on your Wi-Fi and they can't, all of a sudden their whole presentation is screwed. The other thing, too, with that, if they're presenting to a room of 8 people and it's on a little 10-inch screen, really tough to show details of something that's tangible and that you really want to show off the detail in your craft. It's tough to show all that. With a printed portfolio, I can pass out boards or however you want to do it, or a book, and you can pass around and have printed samples. And I think, like, to me, I still fall back to a printed portfolio. But I can see the merits in showing on an electronic device like a tablet.
Again, I think it's a problem solving.
It is.
You have to think about where you, what kind of studio.
Yeah,
you
if it's
get
an interactive
into,
studio,
right?
then you're not. It makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think it's always important to kind of revert back to that. You know.
Yeah, it is. Go back to the root problem.
Yeah, to the problem.
Well, we thank you very much for your time. And is it just gdloft.com?
Yes.
It is.
Yeah. Gdloft.com.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we look forward to catching you later in the future, but congratulations once again on the big win.
Thank you.
And
we
enjoy
appreciate
the rest
it.
Of the Howe Conference.
Oh,
we will.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
The Reflex Blues Show with Donovan Beery is hosted at 36point.com. Music by Dustlab. Find out more at myspace.com/dustlab. Thank you.